I'm Imani Spence, a producer for The Mark Steiner Show, and today I'm talking to Malcolm Peacock, a Baltimore artist who is presenting a solo commission at Druid Hill Park as a part of the Rose Arcade series. But due to weather, the show has been postponed to a later date. For updated information, please follow the event on Facebook by searching Rose Arcade. Let the sun set on you. So tell us a little bit about your show.
Genevra Shea. She's the artistic director of the Contemporary, but she also runs something called Rose Arcade, which is sort of a traveling exhibition series that focuses on artists that are making work that is responsive to a certain site in the world somewhere. So this is the third installment, and I'm really excited. But we will be working with a historical pool at Druid Hill Park and expanding a little bit from that one position, but also focusing some on history of the tennis courts that situate themselves near Commissary and Shop Street. So these are part of the historically black side of Druid Hill Park. So a really, really long story of how the black side of the park became, because in Central Park, the man who designed that park, he also helped to design Druid Hill. He was a really young architect. And black people really weren't able to be in parks, period, in the United States. And the reason that Druid Hill exists was because the city was trying to find a way for people to be able to breathe clean mm-hmm. air. At the time, Baltimore, rather, was the tuberculosis capital of the country, because there was so much soot from trains traveling through
right.
the city.
Yeah, the B&O.
And in Mount Vernon, the houses were so close together that people literally could not really breathe clean enough air. So there were three farms that made up Druid Hill Park, and they couldn't be touched by the city. And the city wanted to build mm-hmm. a road through them for the longest time, but they couldn't be touched. And then when all the slaves were freed, they had grounds to touch it because it's no longer a farm. Which is really interesting. It means, you weren't a farm unless you had slaves.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah.
That's super interesting, especially considering, the intersection of space and race and also the space to actually breathe, literally,
right.
and also, proverbially in Baltimore is really cool.
And I think breathing, there are a few different elements that are going on in the work, but some of our major, focal points that I've been working in are being able to breathe, which I think is really relevant right now, mm-hmm. especially when we're talking about the black body, and is even sort of a coined phrase mm-hmm. too. I can't breathe, but breathing along with how water and how the transfer of water and how black bodies inside of water and what that has meant over time and what that means now for black bodies today. And then lastly, we've had a big focus on light. Looking at the way that light has affected black bodies historically and still are. So at the black historical part of Druid Hill, there are people that aren't black that inhabit that space.
Of course.
But it's majority black men who play tennis at night, and they're all usually, for the most part, over 50 years old, ranging from 50 to 85.
Mm-hmm.
And at sundown, everyone leaves that side of the park.
Right.
And one day during my research, I was like, why is everyone leaving?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the side of the park that was historically whites only does have lights.
Oh, wow.
And those come on at about, different times throughout the year. But
right.
around 7,
mm-hmm.
those will turn on and they'll stay on until sunrise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Druid Hill never really closes.
That's interesting.
Right. But the historically black side really doesn't have lights.
Right.
The city hasn't really said much to the people that use that space
mm-hmm.
about getting lights or about wanting to have lights.
Right.
There are a few on one of the four courts on that side, but they were actually blown out during what the city told the players was an electrical fire.
Interesting.
But they said that they are certain that there was not an electrical fire and that someone...
Okay.
Burned down the shop that was operating those lights.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And just listening to you talk about your work, what was the kind of research like for this piece?
Yeah, so it's been a lot of just there has been so much travel, like so much back and forth to try to go dig up one, maybe literally one name or something right. from one person. So the Afro has helped tremendously. Having the digital archives
has been amazing.
I mean, there were times where I was like, oh, I'm not going to be able to get anything. Mm-hmm. And then it would just sort of fall into place, or I would have to, you know, look for the name of a writer from the 50s and then look up all the stories that they wrote, and I would finally find the one.
Right.
But for the most part, it's actually been, I would say, besides the Afro, the most reliable source, and I think it's really telling, are the narratives of the people who still who have chosen to still go to the space.
Right.
And they have sort of been, you know, my biggest saving grace. It's been a lot of going in and out of feeling upset and then mm-hmm. feeling really, really excited because there were so long where I was looking for people who used those courts or looking right. back at that time and looking for people that went to the pool between the years of 1921 and 56 when it was open
mm-hmm.
and for so long wasn't finding anyone
yeah.
Until I realized that maybe there was an alternate route and the tennis players were really my end to
right.
the court. So
that's so cool. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about when you talk about the people that you're looking for,
mm-hmm.
you're specifically looking for people who are around and using, like you said, those spaces when they were segregated.
Yeah, yeah. So, which is hard because this pool closed in for good in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joyce Scott, who I'm so lucky to be, you know, in contact with,
yeah.
was the person who was responsible for making the commission for this pool to be memorialized, and that happened in 99. But Joyce was a little girl when this pool was closed, so she doesn't even have
mm-hmm.
You know, memories of being of getting to swim in that pool.
Yeah.
So I was like, if I can't get it from Joyce, then it's not going to work. But yeah, I've been this age range is for me the for this work is the. It's the largest spanning range of age that I've ever worked with,
yeah.
which I think is really important, though, in working within any Black narrative, because these stories are so intergenerational.
Yeah,
like these elements are, their stories are definitely like individual stories, but they have so many commonalities that
mm-hmm.
transfer over time.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really cool because I know in your prior work you've talked about Black identity and being a Black person mm-hmm. within art and the different type of work that you've composed. So tell us a little bit
yeah.
about how that your past work has been informed this new sets of work that you're working on.
Yeah, so I think that in this sort of at the start of 2016, I started to try to focus. I was in my second semester of the last year of
mm-hmm.
college, and I really was sort of tired of making work in the school building on
okay.
a white wall, because at the end of the day, even if you're going to show in a museum or in galleries, the work it doesn't really benefit you to be thinking solely about a school space, because
right.
it's only a set amount of time and it's
yeah.
going to end, so you have to be able to start to prepare for life after that. But anyway, I was really in January starting to think about how was my work going to exist in the world and what were the things that I wanted to continue to talk about, but with art becoming something that could be considered part of our reality.
Okay.
Because I think like we often like look at art as something so passive and we can just consume it and we get to escape from it.
Right.
So I wanted to start to create experiential works or works where the viewer sort of had some agency in relation to the Black body because that is very different from any other body giving agency or giving trust or giving empathy or opening themselves up
right.
So it's really, I think, in the United States, one of, if not, in my opinion, the most vulnerable body, the Black body giving even more vulnerability than it's already born with. Like, it's susceptible to even more pain than it's already
right.
born with, and stripping itself down completely. Yes, being able to be critiqued, but hopefully in this getting a reception from an audience that is
yeah.
also empathetic. So
yeah, and positive
yeah,
and loving and
right.
all of those things, which is really
yeah.
difficult.
And yeah, and so language has really been, I think, the kicker in doing that, though, is we have so much wrapped up in language, and
mm-hmm.
there's so much there that we ignore because our language is filtered a certain way.
Yeah.
But when you really sit down and spend time with language, you really get to the core of like of emotion. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what the work has been built off from the last, since January. But it's still so crazy because there's all these art elements that I'm like, oh, that's not going to come into play anymore because I don't do that anymore. But right now I'm in a studio painting, trying to paint 100 objects for that night. So there's still all these weird art things.
Yeah,
that,
convergences.
Yeah, that have to, that sort of, I'm like, oh, great, I still have to do that. But
Yeah. But that's exciting in a lot of ways, especially as you're someone who's been able to come into the city of Baltimore. You're from here, you left for a little bit.
Yeah.
But you're able to find these type of new pieces of history. And how, I guess, when you talk about art being a part of our reality, how do you see art playing a part in oral histories and things like that? I think this piece is really important for that.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're completely right. It is so important, this oral history, because all of these stories that I'm hearing from these people, a lot of them weren't alive. Like, some of them are, you know, but a lot of these people weren't alive, and it's so special to get, like, the raw, or as close as possible to the raw thing as there is. I was talking to one of the gallerists at Platform about this recently. She's a woman of color, and Abby, and she was saying, like, you know, art has always been, she's like, art has just always been around her. It's always been a part of her life. And I noticed, like, people of color, that a lot of my favorite curators, like, they're like, oh, I didn't grow up going to the museums and stuff, but art was always in my house. Music was always in my house.
Yeah.
Creation was always around them. But I think the oral history is really tied to creation, because for people of color, we're not given images of ourselves by default in media. And in order to consume those, we have to create them often because they're so erased. But I think these oral histories are about creating these stories, but then making sure that they have histories that live on beyond the literal. And that's something that we're really trying to do with this space of the pool, is that we're going to have a lot going on this night, but we want to, reintroduce this narrative that Joyce, you know, did an amazing job of resurfacing. However, it has been physically, you'll see, on Friday, sort of erased, and the plaque doesn't exist for it anymore.
Oh, wow.
But hopefully, using the space to establish a new foundation or a foundation for new memories that can happen on that ground.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also really interesting to think about you talking about how these plaques have been erased and how for Black people there's this landmarks are different.
Very,
you know? So even in your show description, you're talking about Thomas who drowned in this pool and like segregation of this pool or the integration.
Integration. Well, because he drowned at he drowned in open water at Patapsco,
So then I was thinking about how many spaces are small. So like my grandmother was the first elevator operator at Hudson's in Detroit, and that's not obviously a big deal. You know, you'll never see a plaque on that in the Hudson's elevator, but those are small little landmarks. And the way that art is totally revitalizing those landmarks and breathing new life and reminding people that like these are important things as well.
Yeah. The sadly though, they're like, what it really comes down to, I think, is there is a black and white reality, and when those landmarks don't exist, what happens is that it's really easy to erase. And so when the landmark's not there, it's easy for someone to come in and develop this like mystery history or this own thing. There were these two Black men walking around the pool one day while I was doing site research, and I asked them if they knew what the pool was, and one of them knew like a good amount, but he had like a lot of the dates were off, a lot of the things that he thought happened. He thought that that was the whites pool, or like he thought that that was the integrated pool. It just like, it shows the way that history gets manipulated over time. But back to what I was saying about it being so black and white, really it comes down to like a willingness to give Black people their content and their knowledge of who they are. And that is something that has been really scary to like a system over time, because giving us knowledge, giving Black people knowledge, empowers Black people, and that has been a very scary thing. It's something that we haven't seen yet, really, like a full mass for every. Obviously, who knows if that's really possible, but for every Black body in the United States to be under complete liberation, under complete enlightenment, would be...
It'd be insane.
Insane. Like, is the United States ready for that? No.
No.
When is the United States ready for that? Who knows? Like,
right.
You know. So, yeah. But I think that things like this do a really good job of hopefully inspiring people to seek out histories.
Yeah.
You know, to seek out stories of who they are and where they're mm-hmm. from and how they can move forward with that knowledge. Because there's, at the end of the day, like, salvation is sort of, is the issue. Like,
right.
That's the key thing. And that we have all these things that we need, like, internally, but it's about tapping into them.
Right.
And restoring them and using them.
Yeah. And that's really interesting. I guess also kind of, when you talk about this, you always talk about how this community of artists has really helped push you through this place, especially in the context of Baltimore being a pretty small city, and especially being like a Black artist in Baltimore,
right.
having a small community. So I guess tell us a little bit more about how that informed where you took this work and how it empowered you.
Right. Yeah. It's so when I moved back here, it was sort of like living this weird childhood fantasy anyway. And Druid Hill was sort of this like land that I wasn't allowed in as a kid, but it was a place I heard of a lot. Like mm-hmm. I wasn't supposed to really be going there.
Okay.
And I remember sort of like sneaking by it
right.
a lot and doing like getting off the light rail. Like I would ride the light rail a lot by myself, and my friends were like really tame and didn't know what they were doing. But maybe I didn't know what I was doing. But yeah, it was after the artist retreat in August with the Contemporary, I left thinking, like, whoa, there are so many Black artists here that are responding to their space, like responding to a relevance that is like really raw and really, really powerful, but is really just, it's at their core. Like it's at the, you know, every single artist at that retreat spoke about identity politics, which some people are really, you know, really get up in arms about, because I can see how some people might think that it's a crutch.
Yeah. That's real.
Yeah. But I think that the people that I saw there have been so helpful to me now, because they've been, oh, like, I'll forward you to this person. Let me get you Sheila's information. Let me
right,
get you.
Right.
So it's really, a lot of them have their own art spheres that are not involved in the, like, the Station North or the Brummo scene.
Yeah.
And they actually have been the people that have known the most about people that were connected to Druid Hill.
Yeah.
Like, way more so than a lot of people in those art scenes.
And that's so important, too, is thinking about the context of art in Baltimore specifically, because I know for me, I'm not originally from here, but I come to the city and I think about all the great things I know about it.
Right.
But I think of, you know, Station Art, Brummo, but those people aren't necessarily tapped into the historic nature of Baltimore, and also they're not necessarily tapped into the more, like, I mean, DIY type of spaces, right? Because, like, Station North is, in some ways, a lot of ways, like, corporately created, right?
Yeah.
And it's great, and we love it, cool. But thinking back and making sure that in all of those spaces, there's someone who says, like, but remember, Baltimore had artists before Station North.
Yeah.
Baltimore had artists before Brummo, before this.
There is a thing with, like, DIY where sometimes I'm like, wait, DIY? I'm like, that's DIY?
But
it's like, because DIY now
means
artists run space too,
right.
And that so but it's like there's a lot of money in those, you
right.
know, and like not all DIY has that type of money, but it's they have been, especially the people who are the artists that I met that were in West Baltimore, because what they have really done is revive for me a part of my personal history that sort of got erased when I became like a young adult.
Okay.
You know, when my parents' cake business sort of halted and stopped,
mm-hmm.
and when that ended. But that was a huge part of, I was in West Baltimore all the time as a
right.
kid, you know, delivering these cakes. Like,
yeah.
as a little, thinking it was nothing, but really was paying our mortgage.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Doing so much with, like, directly in West Baltimore, and having this sort of conflict of identity, though, as we moved
right.
away from the city at times, and feeling trapped inside of a white sphere,
mm-hmm.
and now it's this has been so good, definitely for the self, but it's been great to realize the context in which I always existed, even though I might have physically been in another space.
Yeah, and that's so important. So this piece is going to start at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Friday, 6 on Friday.
September 29th.
I think, is it 30th?
30th. September 30th. Okay. We'll make sure we change that.
Great, awesome.
Yeah, and it'll start at 6 p.m. on the corner of Beechwood Drive and Swan Drive. Is there anything that people should know when they're coming out?
Just look for someone. It's Washington. George Washington is right there. He's in white. Like, he's full white. I don't know what the sculpture is or something. Maybe it's marble or something. I'm not sure. But he's just right there. He's tall. You'll definitely see him. And there will probably be a board with some writing on it right there. Not like an overwhelming amount of writing, but everyone you'll be able to see there will be color or something.
There will be something there that you know you've arrived.
Right, to say like, you have, you are here, yeah.
And so. This is in the third segment in the Rose Arcade series.
Yeah.
Which is exciting.
Which is really exciting. And it's cool to have it be like a solo commission, right out of, like, recently out of school. And working with Ginevra has been, like, I mean, when you're working with other people as an artist, it's hard because you want your thing. Mm-hmm. You, like, I have this thing, and I want this thing, and I like this thing. And it's hard when you throw other people in the mix, but this has been, we've had a lot of things that we've had to troubleshoot and, like, fight through together.
Right.
But we've just been on the same, like, everything has been great.
Amazing.
And we've both been really open to, thank God for Ginevra, because I'm like, there have been some things I wanted to do that I'm just like, this is going to work. And so, yeah. And
that's awesome. But thank you so much, Malcolm, for coming in to talk about this. Definitely go check it out in Druid Hill Park on the corner of Beechwood Drive and Swan Drive. Yeah, Look for the colors.
Great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cool.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Amani Spence. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. And send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.